Welcome. Oh, I'm sorry. The marshal, are you ready, Marshal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The second case on our calendar today is A20-0321, State of Minnesota versus Terry Lee Johnson. This oral argument is being held on the Zoom platform in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. The procedural rules today are the same as for in-person oral arguments. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The marshal will keep the time. You should see the clock just before you start in one of the windows showing the time. We do have any technical difficulties, I'll ask the marshal to stop the clock so you don't lose any time, but hopefully that won't be necessary. The oral argument is being recorded by the Court of Appeals today, and any other recordings are not permitted except with the express prior approval of the Court of Appeals. So when you proceed with your oral argument, I'll ask that you identify yourself and the party you represent. Counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent Terry Johnson, the appellant in this matter. There are two issues before this court today. The first is whether the district court committed reversible error when it instructed the jury that Johnson had a duty to retreat before using reasonable force in self-defense when he was in his own yard. The second is whether the prosecutor committed serious and prejudicial misconduct by repeatedly implying that Johnson had the obligation to bring in evidence to prove his own innocence. Because the answer to both questions is yes, this court must reverse and remand for a new trial. Turning to the first issue, the question of whether a pertinent property is part of a defendant's dwelling for purposes of self-defense was expressly left open by the Supreme Court in State v. Devins. But the court did articulate a rule that's dispositive in this case. And that rule is whether a particular location is part of a defendant's dwelling for purposes of self-defense depends on the extent to which the defendant and his co-residents exercise exclusive possession and control over the area in question. In Devins, the Supreme Court applied that rule to conclude that a common hallway in a multi-unit apartment building is not part of a defendant's dwelling. But applying that rule here compels the opposite conclusion. Unlike Devins, Johnson was in his front yard, over which he and his wife have exclusive possession and control. And that's a technical definition, but I think it really boils down to the question of, is that location home? And here, even more so than a typical front yard, Johnson's front yard was home. Because of the separation between him and his wife, he slept in the camper, and he had to walk back and forth across his yard whenever he wanted to use the bathroom or the kitchen or access running water. That's extremely home-like and fits squarely within the castle doctrine. The idea being that when you are at home, you should be able to defend yourself and you should be safe from attack. And that rule in Devins is supported by a constellation of other cases from both.
Ms. Schultz, before you move on to the other cases, I did want to talk about Devins in a little more detail. You're correct that the court did consider in Devins whether the hallway in the apartment structure was under Devins' exclusive possession and control. But the court also, I think, focused on the reason for the duty to retreat, and that is if, and noted that generally the law requires that a person retreat if reasonably possible before acting in self-defense, and then said, this is because the law presumes that there's somewhere safer to go home. And so when you're in your driveway, as was the case, or as the facts in this case show, I think, isn't there somewhere safer to go, namely the home, the house itself, or to run to another, you know, point, an adjacent property, but more particularly, isn't there a safer place to go, the house itself?
I don't think that's necessarily true. And I think particularly in this case, where Johnson was closest to the camper, but it's not clear that the camper would have been safer. We don't know if there was a lock on the camper. Once you get inside, you're potentially cornered, and you know, the person could be between you and your exit. So I think in this case, it's just not obvious that the house was safer than the yard, where he was able to have a sense of his surroundings. And in the end, I think not only is it not obvious that it's safer, but also in Devins, I don't think that was the driving concern. The court did note that there was somewhere safer to retreat to, because Devins had come out of his apartment and into this common hallway, where there, you know, where lots of people were, tenants and their guests and the landlord. But here, Johnson was just in his own yard. And so the facts are very distinguishable, but also that just wasn't the driving focus of the analysis, and that was the exclusive possession and control. And
Ms. Schultz, just going back to the facts of the case and how they might apply to your argument regarding exclusive possession and control, is it correct that the facts here show that Mr. Johnson actually parked elsewhere and approached the property on foot and was just like picking up some stuff from the residence? And how are we to evaluate those facts in determining whether there was exclusive possession and control here?
Sure. On the night in question, he drove in with his friend WG and WG's wife, and they parked their car in WG's car in the parking lot for the bowling alley, and he did walk over. And Johnson's testimony, and I think WG's testimony as well, was that they didn't want to get in any kind of confrontation. He just wanted to get his stuff and go out. But the facts are undisputed that this was his home, this was his address, all of his things were at this residence. That's why he had to pick up work clothes, because all of his clothes were in the camper. He had two vehicles parked on the property, both his Ford Mustang and his S10 pickup. It's really undisputed that this is, he owns the property with his wife. That's where he stays. We don't really know what he was doing that night. WG said they had been visiting his brother. So I don't know exactly what was going on that night, but I don't think there's really any dispute in the record that this is where he stayed, this is where he lived, he owned the property.
And I guess in an unrelated question, Ms. Schultz, so your opposing counsel argues that no court has, at least recently, extended the Castle Doctrine to encompass an area, you know, not only outside, but not even so proximate to the home itself. Would we be really going out on a limb here, legally speaking, to conclude that there was no duty to retreat?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think this is a straightforward application of the rule in Devins. And I take Your Honor's point that Beard is not recent in any way, but my understanding is that it's good law. And in Beard, the defendant in that case killed another person in self-defense when he was attacked in his orchard, which was 50 to 60 yards away from his house. And that's Supreme Court case law. I didn't do a 50-state survey here, so I don't know what other states have held, but I think the Supreme Court in Devins was clear on what the rule is, and applying the rule, he had exclusive possession and control, and that meant that he had no duty to retreat. And I think that's backed up by other cases as well. We've got the Supreme Court cases in Pencady and this court's case in McEwison that both involve a pertinent structures, but open air porches and decks. And then we have the Supreme Court's case in Bard, where the fight happened, it started outside of a mobile home and moved inside. And there are multiple assault charges. And the Supreme Court found that there was no duty to retreat and didn't distinguish between the assaults that happened outside of the mobile home and the assaults that happened inside. And so I think not only was the Supreme Court clear in Devens about what the rule is, but I think also looking at the prior cases of this court and the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court, it's clear that there isn't a distinction between inside and outside, or there's an operative distinction between inside and outside, or structure and not structure.
Counsel, I wish I could agree with you that Devens is that clear. The court references exclusive possession and control over the area in question. Then it goes also to talk about, as is mentioned earlier here by Judge Cochran, that the Castle Doctrine exception is premised on the notion that one's home is a sanctuary and functions as the resident's safest place when threatened with bodily harm. Are we to, I mean, he might have exclusive use and control over the driveway, but how do we conclude that's the safest place? I mean, it seems to me that that the court found some inconsistent analysis here. Your position, I take it, is if he'd gone in the camper, that would have been more dangerous. Is that what you're saying? That the driveway is the safest place?
I think that the facts certainly support that. But I also think there is some tension in some of these cases between the sort of historical description of the Castle Doctrine and some of the language that's used to talk about what it's for and the rule that's articulated. And I think that's exactly what Your Honor is talking about in Devens, where I think the question is not necessarily, this is about your safest place. It's about, the Castle Doctrine is about not having to retreat from your home. But for Johnson, this was his home. This is where he lived. This is the space that he had to walk back and forth every day if he ever wanted to use his bathroom. This is his sanctuary, and it's a place where you should be free from attacks. And if you are attacked, you should be able to defend yourself.
Schultz, just following up on Judge Cleary's question, and I think you mentioned at the beginning of your argument that the Supreme Court in Devens left open the question about how far the definition of home goes and whether it applies to property outside the home. So aren't you asking us to extend the law, and is that really an appropriate role for the Court of Appeals?
No, Your Honor, I'm asking this court just to apply the analysis in Devens. And it is true that that Devens did not expressly have to apply it to facts like Johnson's, because it didn't need to. It exercised some restraint in saying we don't have to address that question to decide the case here. But it did articulate this rule, and we're asking this court to apply it to these facts. And I don't think that we are asking for a precedential case here, because there is no published case law directly on point, but it is just a straightforward application of the rule that was articulated in Devens. And I think that's within this court's authority. I briefly want to touch on respondents' argument that even if there was error here, it was harmless. And that's just not the case. Looking at other cases where appellate courts have found error, they've almost always reversed, because there's this problem of we don't know whether the jury accepted the defendant's articulation of the facts, but still found him guilty because he failed to retreat, or if they rejected other parts of his testimony. That's just almost impossible to tell. The only case where a court has found that it was not harmless error was in Glowacki, and those facts are real outliers, where even under the defendant's account of the events, the force wasn't reasonable, and the Supreme Court said that no reasonable jury could find otherwise. And so here, the prosecutor argued at trial that he failed to retreat, spent a lot of time on both direct and cross-examination talking about, you know, could he have gone this way? Could he have gone this way? Could he have gone this way? And hit on that in his closing argument. And here, with the jury being instructed that he did have this duty, it's just impossible to tell whether there's no way to find that it was harmless error when that was a critical part of the state's case, and we don't know if the jury relied on that or on something else. So, and I guess I only have a minute left here, but I could touch on also the second issue very briefly. And for that, Montgomery is exactly on point here. What the prosecutor did was analogous to the prosecutor in Montgomery asking the defendant if he had subpoenaed a witness, tried to bring in a witness who would support his case, and this court found that that was inappropriate. It was serious misconduct, prejudicial misconduct, to imply that he could only be believed if he brought in evidence to support his testimony. But I see that I'm running out of time, so if the court doesn't have any more questions for me, we ask this court to reverse and remand for a new trial.
Okay, thank you very much for your argument. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Frank, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Frank, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota, in this criminal appeal. I will briefly touch on both issues. Obviously, we've briefed extensively, and we'll try not to duplicate my comments, but I want to start on the first issue by saying, even if appellant were correct that there is authority to extend the Castle Doctrine, as we've come to call it lately, beyond the physical structure of the home or the dwelling, the real issue here is whether the trial court was wrong as a matter of law when it declined to give the instruction by finding that this was not the defendant's home. The issue of the duty to retreat was brought up by the defendant pre-trial. It was talked about at page 162 of the trial transcript. They also talked about the concept of defensive dwelling, but it was specifically brought up about whether Mr. Johnson was in his home at the time that this altercation happened. The court made a specific finding that the standard self-defense jury instruction would be granted based on the facts and circumstances at trial. That's page 353. And three pages later at 356, the defense made an argument that the driveway is still part of the home for the duty to retreat, and the court denied that. The court denied a defensive dwelling instruction because it occurred outside of the home. And then the court repeated that the standard self-defense instruction would be given, including the duty to retreat, and that's in fact what was given. So implicitly, at least, the court made a specific finding based on the testimony that the court saw and heard that Mr. Johnson was not in his home for purposes of the duty to retreat. The only case that can possibly be construed as supporting a claim that this Castle Doctrine exists outside the physical structure of the home is Pancady. And there, the trial court found as a matter of law that this front porch area, which was, of course, attached to the house, appurtenant to it, was a location to which the defensive dwelling and no duty to retreat applied. That is markedly different, of course, than the actual test set out years later by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Devens, which focuses on exclusive possession and control. And the court said the antithesis of which is the routine use or access by strangers. I assume we all would accept that routine access and use by strangers would apply to a driveway as well, as in this case.
Well, counsel, if I can interrupt for a minute, Devens seems clearly distinguishable with a common area. I mean, the hallway's a common area in an apartment building, not at all the same as a driveway. And the court does go on to talk about the Castle Doctrine and talk about sanctuary. But before we go to that, what about Beard? You passed over Beard. I know it's an old case, but
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It is a U.S. Supreme Court case. The Minnesota Supreme Court have interpreted our self-defense definition through the common law. And so I think Beard is of limited assistance and certainly not authority that this court has to rely on or is bound by. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case, not talking about Minnesota's version. The Minnesota Supreme Court has talked repeatedly and defined repeatedly this duty to retreat in the Castle Doctrine as it applies here. The test is clear as what Devens leaves open, I admit, is this question of, you know, they declined to get into defining all circumstances in which would constitute the home. But if a common hallway in which only some people were granted access based on knowing somebody already in the building is not the home, how can a driveway be a home where people are routinely allowed to drive in?
But isn't that the owner's choice to let people drive in? I mean, as the owner of the property, don't you have the exclusive right to control that area? Go ahead, you can answer.
Sure, and if you put up a fence, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, please answer. Sorry.
Yeah, there is an implied authority to use that driveway. I mean, obviously the victim did here. Every day we see delivery trucks driving up and down our streets, going up into people's driveways and front porches and leaving packages.
Counsel, let me interrupt for a minute, though. I mean, the issue is exclusive. The driveway is the owner's exclusive driveway. The hallway in an apartment building is not exclusive. I'm in apartment A. I can't stop people from visiting apartment B. I mean, they can use that hallway. I can't stop them. So in terms of exclusivity, aren't they distinguishable?
Your Honor, I think it's just the opposite. I don't see how a driveway that is impliedly open for anybody to use for that purpose can be exclusive. Somebody could take efforts to exclude the public or strangers to their driveway. They could put a fence up or a gate. But this is an area where people, strangers, as referenced in Devens, commonly will come to use that driveway for that purpose. And I think it's fairly evident in terms of the test. And the test is quite clear in Devens. Is there a safer place to go? And clearly, Mr. Johnson had a safer place to go, whether it's the house that he got kicked out of or the camper he's living in. That's where he has to retreat to. And so I do think that it is distinguishable from Devens on that basis.
Well, counsel, how does that jive with the fact, with the difference between the porch and going into the smallest room you have in your house? I mean, is your obligation to go what I'm suggesting is when you talk safest place, you can take that too far. Safest place in a house might be a closet in the basement. I mean, at what point is your safest place?
I think the threshold of the home determines the safest place, and that's McQuiston or McKeeston, however that is said, where Mr. McQuiston is standing at the threshold of his front door. And the court reversed his conviction because there was evidence that the victim in that case is coming towards the threshold. Mr. McQuiston was in his home, so he had the right to defend his dwelling and himself. That's the threshold. That's where he can close the door, and there is no implied license to come on into somebody's house. That's exclusive possession. And so that's, to me, where that's where the no duty to retreat kicks in.
So, counsel, you're suggesting that anywhere other than inside the house, the owner does not have exclusive use and control. Front lawn, back lawn, driveway?
I think, Your Honor, the attempts to extend the Castle Doctrine to the curtilage, shall we say, the court has impliedly rejected. In Devens, they declined to extend it beyond the physical structure of the dwelling. And so I don't think the Supreme Court has extended it to the curtilage, if you know, to use that familiar term from Fourth Amendment case law. And I don't think this court can do that. I think it would be going out on the limb. Now, I concede that Pinkady is hard to fit. It's hard to follow. The Supreme Court almost seemed to just accept that that front porch area was part of the home. But we don't have a front porch here. We have a driveway area where you know, other people are using and oftentimes without express permission. So I think it is the threshold of the home, Your Honor. And if it's not, this appellant was not anywhere near the threshold of the home or the front porch. They were out in a driveway walking up towards one another to have this fist fight. The one the brief comments that I will make about the second issue, because I think it's important to stand back and look at the context in which the officer, I'm sorry, in which the prosecutor made these comments. And I think we can identify from the trial transcript, there are basically three reasons why the prosecutor was asking about the knife itself. One was because the state had to prove a dangerous weapon. And so the state had the burden beyond a reasonable doubt of proving that he used a dangerous weapon. There was some testimony about a screwdriver and Mr. Johnson himself said he used a small knife.
Also, at one point, counsel, can I interrupt a minute? Because in terms of why the prosecutor did it, I'm less interested in knowing why this isn't Montgomery, and that the failure to subpoena a witness, is that different than going after someone for the failure to present physical evidence?
It is, Your Honor. I think Montgomery presents a much more obvious situation. We are all told that you cannot comment on the failure to call a witness, and that's a very specific rule. And so that is a different rule. There's a more specific rule. It may be based in the same reasoning. You can't comment on the failure to call a witness in part because the defendant has no burden, but the defense can't comment on the state's failure to call a witness either. So it is a different rule. It's a more specific rule. Here, I think the context is important. As I said, this was the one element was a dangerous weapon. The state was also trying to impeach the defendant's credibility when he was testifying about his reasonable fear. And you can see on page 406 of the transcript, that's what the prosecutor is getting at. And also the prosecutor is trying to establish this lull in the fight to rebut this, or really to prove the lack of self-defense. And that in the cross-examination at pages 330 and 338, and in the closing and rebuttal arguments at page 392 and 431. Those are instances where they're demonstrating the context in which he's asking. In our brief, we used the term, he may have inartfully asked it. And I think he was candid when when there was an objection later made that he indicated he did not mean to imply that. So
excuse me for a minute. He may not have meant to do it, but the comment, pretty easy to bring it in, show it, is what concerns me the most.
Right. And it's when we're talking about whether this is error, it is, of course, error to suggest that the defendant has a burden. The prosecutor reminded the jury himself that it was his burden to prove everything. And the argument I'm saying is that it may be error, but it is just barely error. And it is concerning, but it was not intentional by the prosecutor. He had a basis for asking these questions, and they were factual disputes that the prosecutor had a burden to address and to prove. So that's the context in which they were made. It was, I think, in that particular comment, Judge Cleary, that you point out is what was really inartful, but he was trying to prove his case. It's harmless.
Mr. Frank, would you agree then that comments that insinuate that the defendant had a duty to bring in the evidence is error?
I am struggling with the term insinuate, Your Honor, but yes, I will agree that it's a slippery, it's not a slippery slope. There are gradations, I think. And the point I'm trying to make is this is not the strongest example of that insinuation, which is wrong. And I think that also factors into the harmlessness, because we have to assess how much did this really influence the jury. When there were legitimate areas of inquiry, it wasn't outrageous conduct by the prosecutor, certainly. The prosecutor reminded the jurors of the state's burden. The court properly instructed. Even the defense attorney quite honorably reminded the jury. And I think it's also important to remember the defendant's testimony here, that at one point he testified he wanted to keep fighting and stabbed him. I mean, the testimony of the defendant is what convicted him, because he admitted that yes, there was an exchange of punches, but then he wanted to end this. He wanted to one-up the victim, and took out a knife and stabbed him. And so with the overwhelming strength of, you know, the defendant's own testimony, that's what convicted him, not this slight suggestion that he had some duty to produce the knife. So for those reasons, Your Honors, I would ask the court that, you know, even if there was error, it was harmless in the context of the entire case, and affirm the convictions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Schultz, any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I've got just a few points that I want to address here. And the first is regarding the second issue. Counsel for the state said that the prosecutor here was just trying to prove his case. And in some ways, that was the problem, that the state had a problem where it didn't turn up this knife. And, you know, it's the prosecutor said that in opening argument, but that's not an excuse to ask inappropriate questions and invite an inference from the defendant's testimony that, you know, that it's his fault that they didn't have the knife, and that, you know, if only he brought it in, then he could stand up and prove his own innocence. And that's inappropriate. And I don't think, you know, the Peltier factors, I don't think the prosecutor's intention factors in at all. The three factors are pervasiveness, strength of the state's evidence, and whether the defense had a chance to rebut. And the first two factors weigh heavily in favor of prejudicial error here. And it's pervasive because it happened twice. It happened both on cross-examination over the course of a few different questions, and then also right at the end in closing argument. That really gives the jury a chance to let that sink in and then reinforce it later. As far as the second one goes, the state's evidence is ambiguous and mixed. Part of our harmless error, our argument that, you know, any instructional error wasn't harmless at the beginning, is that we don't know what made the jury convict him, whether it was that they rejected that. I think credibility is the central factor at this trial, because we've got Johnson.
Ms. Schultz, if the district court's self-defense instruction was proper, is it still your position that the state's evidence was not strong? It seems to me if the self-defense instruction was proper, the state does have strong evidence in this case, given appellant's own testimony and the other testimony.
I think it's a harder argument for sure, but I think the strength of the state's case is still not strong enough to overcome this kind of error, because it did hinge on credibility. Everything kind of came down to whether you believed Johnson or whether you believed SL. And the implication the state made when the prosecutor implied that if Johnson were to be trusted, he would have brought in this evidence that would exonerate him. And the implication they invited, the prosecutor invited, is that Johnson wasn't trustworthy and that he was hiding something. And that really goes to the heart of his self-defense claim, that you know, his not only was his version of events honest and accurate, but also the fact that it was a pocket knife versus some other kind of weapon, it also implicates the reasonableness of his self-defense claim, because if he pulled something out from his pocket, something he routinely carries, that's a very different situation than if he had grabbed, say, a kitchen knife from the camper when he went out to meet SL. So I think here it is true that the state's evidence looks stronger if we did have a duty to retreat, that there's still plenty of evidence that, I mean, Johnson's testimony was that he wasn't able to retreat, that he was scared that he was going to get beat up and that he was going to keep coming for him, and that SL was way bigger than him, had experience fighting. So I think there's still a lot of evidence going both ways. And finally, I also want to touch briefly on the difference between possession and implied license or implied use. And here it is a driveway. Strangers, I mean, I think Judge Cleary pointed out that it's only because Johnson allows strangers for a very limited purpose to use the driveway that that anyone is ever there. And the fact that he has that possessory interest, that's not eviscerated by allowing some limited use. Just because a delivery truck can come in and deliver a package on the driveway doesn't mean that a stranger can just go there and hang out or pick a fight. And so here, I think all of the evidence points toward exclusive possession and control. I see that my time is running out, but we ask this court to reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. They were very helpful. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.